the headlines. Heavy fighting underway in several Ukrainian cities. Kiev cuts diplomatic ties with Moscow, accusing Russia of launching a war of aggression. Iran says the Western parties need to make political decisions in the Vienna talks in order for the discussions to yield results. And the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says Israel is on the decline and that the regime's demise is only a matter of time. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour. Heavy fighting is underway in Ukraine between the Russian army and pro-Russian forces on the one side and the Ukrainian military on the other. The Ukrainian military says Russia is shelling areas across Ukraine all the way to the western Lviv region. It has so far confirmed the death of dozens of servicemen. The military also claims that as many as 50 Russian troopers have been killed in the fighting. According to Ukraine's border guards, Russia's ground forces, as well as heavy equipment, have crossed into Ukraine from several directions. But Ukraine's interior ministry says that it's not expecting to see attacks on residential buildings and civilian infrastructure. Meanwhile, President Volodymyr Zelensky said that Ukraine is ready for anything and that it will win. He has introduced martial law across the country, but is asking the citizens not to panic.
This morning, Russia launched a new military operation against our state. This is a completely groundless, cynical invasion. We, the citizens of Ukraine, have been determining our own future since 1991. But now, what is not only our country's future, but also the future of how Europe will live. We are imposing martial law in all regions of our state.
Zelensky says he's building an anti-Putin coalition. He's accused Putin of seeking to destroy Ukraine. Zelensky has ordered the military to inflict maximum losses on Russia. Kiev has also cut diplomatic ties with Moscow, accusing Russia of launching a war of aggression. Meanwhile, the Russian Defense Ministry says it has conducted precision strikes against military infrastructure, Ukrainian air bases, and degraded its air defenses, but it's giving assurances that the civilian population is facing no threats. The fighting began in the early hours of Thursday after Putin authorized a special military operation in Ukraine's Donbas region.
Circumstances require us to take decisive and immediate action. The People's Republic of Donbas turned to Russia with a request for help. In this regard, I have decided to conduct a special military operation. Whoever tries to interfere with us, and even more so to create threats for our country, our people should know that Russia's response will be immediate and will lead you to such consequences that you've never experienced in your history.
Putin says NATO's expansion to include Ukraine is unacceptable, and that Russia has been left with no choice but to defend itself against threats emanating from Ukraine. Still, Putin says Russia has no plans to occupy Ukrainian territory, but he's called on the Ukrainian military forces to lay down their arms and go home. I'm being told now that our correspondent, Said Purazo, is joining us from the British capital, London, with the latest on the developments right now unfolding in Ukraine. Said, so much has been happening over the past few hours. Talk to us about the response and where the UK stands with regards to how events have been unfolding. And also, there's a lot of talk about a lack of unity among European countries. What more can you tell us about that as well?
It sure has. A lot of things have happened over the past few hours. I'll start with the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's tweet earlier today, saying that, quote, "I am appalled by the horrific events in Ukraine, and I have spoken to President Zelensky to discuss next steps. President Putin has chosen a path of bloodshed and destruction by launching his this unprovoked attack on Ukraine. The UK and our allies will respond decisively." Now, how decisive the response will be is the question mark here, Bardia. We understand that the UK Prime Minister has held that famous COBRA meeting since this morning, we're yet to see what will come out of that. He will be heading to Parliament today to address the MPs, and we'll probably see a lot of demands coming from across the aisle in the British Parliament as to the next steps. And also, what we understand that the Russian ambassador has been summoned to the UK Home Office. So far, the response from the UK, as we saw on Monday, the British Prime Minister announcing sanctions against five Russian banks, as well as three Russian billionaires close to the Kremlin. But what we're going to see moving forward, we'll probably see the UK mirroring the kind of action and rhetoric that we have seen come out of the European Union, as well as the United States. This morning, for example, we heard from the European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, echoing the same words, followed by the High Commissioner, Josep Borrell, calling it a dark day in history. So pretty much the same words to be uttered, probably. But what we also saw in the British Parliament on Monday was more calls from across the aisle, from both the opposition as well as the Prime Minister's own Conservative Party, for more and tougher action against Russia prior to the developments that have taken place today. Of course, those came after Russia announced the two breakaway republics of Donetsk and Luhansk as independent. So as for whether or not there is unity among the members of the European Union, it's a very good question. The answer is no. There is distance between the kind of action or position they have taken on this whole issue, and probably that has something to do with the following. One is energy that you discussed earlier with Jerome Hughes, Russia providing Europe with up to 40% of its energy needs. Germany, for example, relying on Russian gas by 50%. So that definitely has an impact on the way they approach it. Of course, we saw Germany halt the ratification, the certification of that famous Nord Stream 2 pipeline to take Russian gas all the way to Germany. And of course, that was followed by sanctions from the United States. Here in the UK, for example, for so many years, it's been an open secret. Things like the London laundromat, how Russian money ended up in the British financial system on its way to some other parts of the world, or the $2 billion worth of property owned by Russians in the United Kingdom, and also words that certain Russians contributed financially to the coffers of the Conservative Party at the time of the election that led to the election of Boris Johnson, or the fact that he played tennis with certain influential Russian individuals here in UK. Those things no doubt have an impact on the decisions that are made by these heads of state in the UK, all the way to the European Union and elsewhere. But as I say, we're going to have to see how decisive the coming actions will be when we hear from the British Prime Minister today, when he comes out of that COBRA meeting and addresses Parliament. Later on today, we also understand that there will be a protest in solidarity with the Ukrainians happening in London in later today. Protests or demonstrations happening as we speak in Germany, as well as in Paris, the French capital. We also heard, if you could go over quickly, what the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said earlier. Giving assurances, but no promises of troop deployment into Ukraine. He said that they were not surprised, that they had seen it coming, that they had taken action in preparation. But he went on to say that they only bolstered the defenses of what he called NATO allies, Poland and all the rest, countries that share border, for example, with the Baltic states that share borders with, let's say, Belarus or Russia. So assurances of more support for security for NATO member states, but not any word of troop deployment into Ukraine. There will be a virtual meeting of the NATO heads of state in, I think, happening tomorrow, as well as an EU summit happening this evening. This evening in Brussels, the of course the headquarters of the European Union. So, as far as the European Union and the UK are concerned, yes, divisions in the way that they are approaching the escalation in Ukraine, but similar measures so far, such as the announcement of sanctions, and we're expecting more sanctions to be levied against Russia in today's announcement by the British Prime Minister. If you recall, he said Monday that was the first barrage, to borrow his own words, so the first tranche, as he said, of sanctions against Russian banks, as well as a number of three, to be exact, Russian billionaires close to the Kremlin. It's only a matter of wait and see, Bardia, at this point. The British Prime Minister expected in the coming hours to announce new measures as to how Britain will be moving forward. Britain, of course, being a country that has been training Ukrainian troops since 2014 and 15, they have contributed financially to Ukraine.
All right, thanks a lot. Saeed Puruza joining us from the British capital, London. Staying on the topic, we reached out to former U.S. Army officer Scott Bennett to get his perspective on the latest flare-up in Ukraine. He believes that the Ukrainian government has been serving as a puppet of the West against Russia during the last few U.S. administrations.
The people of Lugansk and Donetsk have been crying out for deliverance from the artillery shells, from the shootings, from the roadside bombs, from the brutality that the Nazi far-right Ukrainian thugs that are paid for by the U.S. and the United Kingdom to be a puppet regime against Russia. These poor people have been crying out for deliverance, and Russia has heard their cry, and the people of the Duma have heard their cry, and Vladimir Putin has honored the words of the Russian people in the Duma and sent troops in to protect these people, not to destroy Ukraine, not to destroy the people of Ukraine, not even to overthrow the Ukrainian government, but to protect lives that have been targeted and murdered by the United States and by the United Kingdom using their puppets in the Ukrainian government and the regime of Zelensky, and before that, Poroshenko.
Meantime, reactions keep coming in over the start of Russia's military operations against Ukraine. Iran's foreign minister has blamed NATO for the crisis. Hossein Amir Abdullahian has in a tweet said that the Ukraine crisis has its roots in the Western alliance's provocative moves. According to the top diplomat, Iran believes resorting to war is not the right solution. Rather, efforts should be focused on working out a political and diplomatic solution as well as establishing a ceasefire. Meanwhile, China has said that Russia's recent military operation should not be referred to as an invasion, calling on all sides to exercise restraint. Earlier, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has reacted to Russia's military move.
This conflict must stop now. This war doesn't make any sense. It violates the principles of the Charter, and it causes, or will cause, if it doesn't stop, a level of suffering Europe has not known since at least the Balkanic crisis.
Also, President Joe Biden has said that the U.S. and its allies will respond in a united and decisive way to any unprovoked and unjustified attack by the Russian military on Ukraine. He said Putin has chosen a premeditated war that will bring a catastrophic loss of life and human suffering. British ambassador to Ukraine, Melinda Simmons, has also weighed in, dismissing Russia's operation as, in her own words, an unprovoked attack on a peaceful country. And the president of the European Commission has reacted, saying that President Putin is putting the future of Russian people at risk.
I call on Russia to immediately stop the violence and to withdraw its troops from Ukraine's territory. We will not let President Putin tear down the security architecture that has given Europe peace and stability over many decades. We will not allow President Putin to replace the rule of law by the rule of force and ruthlessness. He should not underestimate the resolve and strength of our democracies. And history
has proven. She added a package of massive and targeted sanctions against Russia will be presented to European leaders for approval later on Thursday. Meanwhile, EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell echoed similar remarks, dismissing the operation as a violation of international law. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg also condemned Russia's military operations, a reckless attack which puts the lives of countless civilians at risk. France has said that Russia's operation amounts to a disregard for international law, while Germany has called on Moscow to stop the operation. Iran's senior negotiator in the Vienna talks says the European sides need to make certain decisions in order for the discussions to produce a desired result. Ali Baghdadi-Kani posted a tweet a short while ago in which he said that getting close to the finish line does not necessarily mean that it will be crossed. He urged caution and perseverance to take the last step. Baghdadi called on parties to the talks to adopt a balanced approach. Negotiating teams are continuing their discussions in Vienna to reach a final agreement. Iran has said time and again that it will not compromise on the rights and interests of its people. Tehran has also called on the Europeans to show some flexibility and initiative and avoid politicizing the talks. Iran says negotiations will continue until a result is achieved, adding that talks with the U.S. are not on the agenda. Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah warns Israel against waging a war on Lebanon, adding that his forces are completely prepared for any attack. In an interview with Al-Manar TV, Nasrallah said the Israeli regime is on the decline and on the path to demise. He said the demise of the Israeli regime is only a matter of time, suggesting that the term temporary regime to be used for Israel. Nasrallah said Hezbollah seeks justice and peace and would defend the Lebanese people and their freedom. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.org. IR. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Our fiqh, our jurisprudence, our social knowledge, our humanities, our political and our different methods should improve on a daily basis. However, these components should be handled by skilled individuals, by experts, by those who are good at thinking, by those who have the qualifications to introduce new methods. Half-educated and incompetent individuals and those who make extravagant claims cannot accomplish anything. This topic should receive attention. All these issues are on a path that can deviate to the left or to the right. Therefore, we should take the middle of the path. Supporting unprivileged classes of the people is also important. One of the main principles and values of the Islamic Republic is supporting unprivileged classes. Another important role in supporting the oppressed wherever they are in the world. These are the main values of the revolution, and they cannot be sidelined. If someone, some people, and some orientation are indifferent to unprivileged classes and to the oppressed people among the world, they're missing criteria.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, if this commitment to fundamental values this was the first criterion exist, the movement will be a continuous and a straight movement, one that will not change in the whirlwind of events. However, if this commitment does not exist, the opposite, which is excessive pragmatism, will occur. This means taking a different direction every day. It means that every event can drag us this way and that. The temptations of this or that and my own whims drag me to different directions like a blade or straw. This is pragmatism, which means being included towards different sides on a daily basis. This contradicts the commitment that I spoke about. In the Holy Quran, this commitment to values has been referred to as steadfastness. Therefore, be steadfast as you are commanded. You and those with you turn unto Allah. Holy Quran, chapter 11, verse 112. This is a Quranic ayah and verse from the Holy Surah Hud.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Britain has sought to restore its influence and colonial rule in West Asia by pursuing aggressive and interventionist policies in the region. UK's first direct military involvement, the 21st century, began in Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks. UK officials beat the drums of war. Then Prime Minister Tony Blair, who was referred to as George W. Bush's poodle, played a key role in paving the way for UK's militarism. It has now emerged that British forces committed war crimes in Afghanistan. Documents show senior military officers buried evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. UK Special Forces officers killed unarmed Afghans who posed no threats. In 2003, London followed Washington's lead in accusing Iraq's former regime of possessing weapons of mass destruction.
So that was the UK's role, was to provide cover for the Americans. And of course, the Americans, the UK sees America as a means of getting a sort of protection, getting the big brother on their side, which they've, you know, following on from their experiences in 1945, the British establishment have a terrific fear of being left on their own to face a major continental enemy.
The UK, alongside the US, invaded Iraq without the UN mandate. British forces were primarily stationed in southern Iraq. British soldiers tortured hundreds of Iraqi detainees between 2003 and 2009. But no action was taken to hold the British government accountable for the war crimes that it committed there. Following the invasion of Iraq, an inquiry team was set up to investigate Britain's military intervention in the Arab nation. The Chilcot report said the UK chose to invade Iraq before peaceful options had been exhausted. It also said the former UK Premier, Blair, exaggerated the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. It also said that Blair ignored warnings on what would happen in Iraq after its invasion.
We have concluded that the UK chose to join the invasion of Iraq before the peaceful options for disarmament had been exhausted. Military action at that time was not a last resort.
London is one of Saudi Arabia's staunch supporters. UK-made weapons are used by the Saudi regime against the Yemeni people. The UK is one of Saudi Arabia's leading arms suppliers, along with the US. It is also a major supplier of arms to the United Arab Emirates, another country in the coalition that is bombing Yemen. The UK has continued to support airstrikes by Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners. It has provided both arms and ongoing maintenance and support, in spite of overwhelming evidence of repeated breaches of international humanitarian law by the coalition.
Well, its colonial interest is historical. I don't believe that anyone is trying to get Lawrence of Arabia back into the peninsula anymore. I don't think the British, even the most purblind British, don't think they can recreate the empire.
The UK-made equipment used in the war includes Typhoon and Tornado aircraft, Paveway bombs, and Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles. The published value of UK arm licenses for export to the Saudi-led coalition since the bombing began in 2015, in March, is £8.4 billion. However, estimates showed that the real value of arms to Saudi Arabia is over £20 billion, while the value of sales to the coalition as a whole is over £22 billion.
Such hideous weaponry, and we are actually inviting
oppressive regimes and dictatorships to come and buy this weaponry, knowing that it will be used against the people of Palestine, knowing it's going to be dropped on the heads of the people of Yemen, is appalling.
It is now believed that given the U.S. withdrawal from the West Asia region, or minimal presence, the U.K. is moving in to replace the U.S. while pursuing to restore its colonial influence and role in the West Asia region.
Around a month ago, Israeli media reported that the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, has increased its drone activities in Israeli airspace. The drone operations were mainly for gathering intel. Last Friday, the Israeli military activated the Iron Dome and scrambled fighter jets, but failed to intercept a drone from Lebanon. As a result, air raid sirens were sounded in the north, and later it was announced that Israeli fighter jets were spotted flying low over Beirut. Hezbollah later released a statement saying the drone named Hassan entered Israeli airspace on a reconnaissance mission at a depth of 70 kilometers for around 40 minutes before returning untouched. This was the second incident in as many days and comes after Hezbollah's Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah said the group was making its own drones in Lebanon. Pointing to Israeli threats, the Hezbollah chief said the enemies only threaten others with war, but they know it will be very difficult and costly for them. He said Hezbollah is capable of upgrading the quality of its rockets to fend off Israeli threats. In fact, Hezbollah has been increasing its fleet of unmanned aerial vehicles, and now it is estimated to have some 2,000 UAVs. Based on Israeli media reports, Hezbollah is also in possession of over 100,000 rockets, and Israel's existing missile systems neither are capable of intercepting such a number of missiles and rockets, nor can protect Israeli settlers. The launch of the radio-controlled aircraft on Friday seems like a message from Hezbollah. Even if the Israeli military sometimes manages to shoot down Hezbollah's UAVs or drones, the resistance movement can keep sending them into Israel at will. If Israel believes it is free to violate Lebanese sovereignty with UAVs and fighter jets, Hezbollah will do the same south of the border.
It is interesting to see how fragile its entire military industrial complex actually is, and the latest event has just showed it once again that even though the Israeli regime is investing so many efforts in its so-called defense, it remains very weak, and it is the Lebanese resistance that continues to show the Israeli regime its own weakness.
Previously, retired Israeli General Yitzhak Brek warned that the Israeli military is not ready for any future war, especially a multi-front one. He predicted that in an extreme scenario, the resistance movements in Syria, Yemen, and Iraq, as well as Hamas in the Gaza Strip, will launch missiles and drones at Israel, so that the average number of rockets fired at the regime will reach 3,000 a day. Add to it reports during the Israel-Palestine conflict in May, when Israel's official military data indicated that the Iron Dome only destroyed fewer than half of the rockets and mortars fired by Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements toward Israel. Therefore, in case of an all-out war, the Israeli regime would be vulnerable. While Tel Aviv sees its power waning, the resistance front has managed to increase its prowess. This is while Israel is trying to sell the Iron Dome missile system to Arab nations, but how can the Iron Dome work for them when it did not work for Israel?
This is why the entire existence of the so-called State of Israel in its current form necessitates the ongoing killing of people and ongoing expansion of its military complex. But at the same time, of course, it remains fragile. This is a very existential contradiction within the Israeli colony that eventually will also probably lead to its to the fall of the apartheid regime and the Israeli hegemony, supposed hegemony in the region.
The editor-in-chief of Rayal Yom newspaper, Abdel Bari Atwan, says a small drone that is worth only $100 manages to penetrate into Israel's airspace, despite the Tel Aviv regime's costly military equipment and the Iron Dome system. He says Persian Gulf Arab states that are racing to buy this system from Israel should give it a second thought after the regime's failure against the Hezbollah resistance movement's drones. World leaders participated in the 58th Munich Security Conference in Germany, which is held annually. This year's conference was dominated by the Ukraine crisis, as major Western powers accused the Kremlin of zeroing in on an imminent invasion of Ukraine. In the conference, the U.S. Vice President, Kamala Harris, announced that Washington and its allies will impose significant and unprecedented economic costs on Russia if it further invades Ukraine.
We will impose far-reaching financial sanctions and export controls. We will target Russia's financial institutions and key industries.
Harris also added the U.S. will not stop with economic measures, but will further reinforce the eastern flank of NATO. Harris said some 6,000 additional service members are already deployed to Romania, Poland, and Germany. The official also noted that some 8,500 troops in the United States are on high alert. Also, another high-profile attendee in the 2022 Munich Security Conference, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, said Britain could block Russian companies from raising capital in London and has passed legislation to widen sanctions on Russian businesses and individuals if the country invades Ukraine. Johnson also stated that Russia would pay a heavy military price if it invaded Ukraine. Britain has already sent hundreds of troops to Poland to support NATO's eastern flank. However, the chairman of the Munich Security Conference, Wolfgang Eisinger, has highlighted the need for dialogue to resolve the differences. He said our world is in danger, traditional certainties are crumbling, threats and vulnerabilities are multiplying, and the rules-based order is increasingly under attack. He noted that the need for dialogue has never been greater. Meanwhile, Russia has time and again denied any intention to invade its western neighbor. It argues that it's deployed the military near Ukraine's borders to protect itself amid NATO's eastward expansion. Also, in a major step toward de-escalation, last week Moscow withdrew some of its troops near the Ukrainian border after completing military exercises. The U.S. President Joe Biden has ramped up his rhetoric against Russia amid mounting tension in Eastern Europe. He once again repeated his claim that Washington had intelligence showing his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, has made up his mind to invade Ukraine.
We have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days. We believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people.
Speaking at the White House, Biden warned that war will close the window for diplomacy with Moscow. Biden also said Western countries won't deploy troops in Ukraine, but will continue to bolster their defensive capabilities. Earlier, the White House said Washington and its allies are working on a sanctions package in case of a Russian invasion. This is while Italy says the bans should not target energy imports from Russia. This could throw the EU economy into mayhem or even negatively affect Russia's gas supplies to Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Nearly 38% of Russia's exports went to the EU, while over 36% of Russia's imports came from Europe. Russia is also the origin of 26% of EU's oil imports and 40% of EU's gas imports.
I don't think Russia cares so much and worries so much about Western sanctions, because Russia proved for the years, in spite of Western pressure and different sanctions, capable to sustain and even improving slowly, not so good as before, its economy. So sanctions are not the main threat to Russia.
The U.S. accuses Russia of planning an attack on Ukraine, but Moscow says that is not true. Therefore, the latest warnings, based on unfounded accusations that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is just around the corner, would further complicate the situation at this critical time.
The Australian government announces a plan to blacklist the whole of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The country had previously designated Hamas's military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades back in 2003. Under the new restrictions, which will go into force in April, financing or providing any support to Hamas will be criminalized, with some offenses carrying a 25-year prison sentence. The reason for the blacklisting is what Canberra calls the group's, quote, hateful ideologies. But let's dive deeper and learn more about the Gaza-based group. Ever since Hamas scored a landslide victory in Gaza's parliamentary elections in 2006, it has been running the besieged enclave. Protecting the Strip has been one of the group's core responsibilities. Over the years, it has carried out the responsibility, the most recent instance of which came in May 2021, during the Israeli military's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip. The war killed some 250 Palestinians, including 66 children, but only 12 Israelis. If it weren't for the deterrent capabilities of the group, the number of Palestinian casualties would have been a lot higher. How would this justify branding the group as a terrorist organization? The case in point is that any group whose ideology goes against that of the U.S. and its allies is hit with such allegations. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem condemns Australia's decision to list the movement as a terrorist organization and calls on the Australian government to present an apology to the Palestinian people. He said the planned move attests to the biased support for the occupying regime and emboldens Israel to press ahead with its aggression against Palestinian people. The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Resistance Committees were also among Palestinian groups denouncing the decision. Voices of condemnation also came from inside Australia. The Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network, a national coalition of Australians who support Palestinian rights, disagreed with the designation, saying that it does nothing to advance the cause of peace and will only create more suffering for the 2 million people currently living under the 15-year Israeli blockade.
The word terrorist has been essentially coined and put into circulation by Zionists to demonize the people who are resisting their genocide in Palestine and the people all over the world who support that resistance. And in fact, the actual meaning of the word terrorism is deliberately targeting civilians to create fear or terror. And that is a military tactic that has been used since time immemorial by all sorts of different forces.
All in all, in the absence of any meaningful support for the people of Palestine and the condemnation of Tel Aviv, Israel continues to commit gross violations and gets away with murder.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
He himself says that when I was invited to travel to Iran, I came to Iran, had a meeting with Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, and after that he decides to study about Islam.
So he was such a man, not only believing that I have found the right path, though I'm only going to commence on this path. Mm-hmm. So because of this, he presented two refugees, not only there, even for the camps, for the migrants who would refuge to Norway.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Zainia. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Zainia, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So the program, The Teacher, is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim philosophers, thinkers, jurists, and dignitaries all across the nation of Islam. And today we want to talk about a man who converted into religion of Islam. Of course, he's not, we can't say, a philosopher or a jurist. He is a physician, but he has been, we can't say, the source of benefit and source of endeavors a lot, especially in the occupied Palestine. He is no one but Dr. Trond Ali Lindstad. Okay, Sheikh Zainia, let's start with you. What information do we have about the life of Trond Ali Lindstad?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dr. Trond Ali Lindstad is a physician, as you mentioned, who was born in 1942 in Oslo, in Norway. And he was born in a Christian family. His family was a practicing family in Christianity, and he believed in the teachings of Christianity deeply. He spent his youthhood in Norway and studied in medicine, and after that moved to England to complete his studies. And it's notable to know that during his younghood, because it was the age of Cold War and the world was, you know, tending toward fighting against capitalism, the world was feeling that if you want to stand against capitalism, you have no way out but to resort to communism.
Okay.
So that's why he tended to be a communist at mm-hmm. the beginning of his, you know, young age. I mean, when he was 20, 25 okay. years old. And it's normal. Every person at yes. that time may have this, you know, mindset. After that, because he was, you know, against the idea of capitalism, mm-hmm. and because of the propaganda of Israel, okay. he moved to Israel and even worked for some months in the farms that was belonged to Jews. But he says that according to the actions of Zionists yeah. there, I understood that the story is not correct and their behavior is different mm-hmm. from what I've been told before.
Okay.
So he got out from
Israel.
Israel.
Yes.
And after that, he works in the camps for Palestinian people.
The Palestinian refugees yes. in the camps, yes.
So okay. he works as a physician, as, yes. as a doctor
yes.
in those camps and tries to help them and mm-hmm. to help the injured to,
okay.
To the people who okay. are injured as the you know result of the bombardment.
Yes.
And after the Islamic Revolution of Iran, he decides to convert into Islam. That okay. it has also a story that yes. inshallah we will.
Sheikh Mahdavi, do you know the story of his conversion to Islam?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Actually, this is what he announced publicly, that he has converted to Shia Islam, and it was specifically out of the effect or out of the impact of the revolution, and also because of the leadership of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi. Mm-hmm. So most of the time, as we had in our program also, we see people here and there all around the world, they may convert into Shia Islam, but they do not say it publicly. They may hide it because of some certain
problems that one
circumstances yes. they yes. are living in.
Okay.
So for a native Norwegian man to say it publicly at least you have to pay the cost. And we see that Ali Lienstad,
yes,
he paid the cost. I think this is good to give these two titles to this noble man. When I was reading his biography, I was interested in these two titles as Father of the Refugees.
Okay.
This is one title. And another title, you may say, the victim of being anti-Zionist.
Mm-hmm.
Because two titles are fitting his lifestyle.
Yes.
Why the story goes like this, that because of his lifetime services to refugee here and there, as my brother mentioned, at the border of Lebanon and Palestine, there are many refugee camps.
Yes.
So people who are actually fleeing from the Palestine because of the bombardment of Israel, they must be actually settled down in those places, or they must be given place in those camps. So they are in need of some services.
Of physicians, and, especially those who are injured, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. And not every physician dares to go there.
Yo, yeah, man.
And we see he didn't only go there. He created a group of physicians.
Oh.
So he was such a man, not only believing that I have found the right path, though I'm only going to commence on this path. He said, okay, now let's establish a group.
Mm-hmm.
So because of this services, he presented the two refugees, not only there, even for the camps, for the migrants who would refuge to Norway, because Norway also is considered as one of those European countries who receive many migrants throughout the year because of all these wars that Western countries, they themselves established against Muslim countries.
Okay.
By the way, because of the services that he presented to these people, we see that Fifth Harald, actually from the royal family of Norway, he was forced to give the medal, but he couldn't continue insisting on this actually ceremony. I mean, to give this medal of honor to him.
Okay.
Because of the Zionist pressure in the Norway.
Oh.
This is the reason why I'm saying that he was the victim of being anti-Zionist.
Oh.
So for the first of the story, I was trying to say that he is the father of refugees.
So the whole ceremony was cancelled? The whole ceremony was cancelled, huh? The medal was not
given. They took it back. They took it back. And it was a big scandal. And it was a big scandal for Norwegian royal family, and we see in the media even public couldn't tolerate this withdrawal of the medal, and there are a lot of documentaries on it.
The Zionist lobbies, you know, are working here and there in every country, and everybody who's against them, you know, must be eliminated from the scene of the history. This is what the Zionists are doing, and the Zionist behaviors is criticized by the Jews themselves too, those justice seekers who are after the Palestinians. You know, so many years they have occupied the lands, they killed the innocent children, women and men of the Palestine. And people like Trond Ali Lienstad are really great and brave, I think, to endanger their lives in order to go into the battle scenes, helping the refugees, especially the injured ones, and use their medicine. You know, he could have a very comfortable, cozy life in Norway, you know, in one of the hospitals at least, to be the head of the hospital. But he endangers his life, you know, risks his life and the life of his colleagues going over there. Chexia, any other point about his life?
I want to highlight two points in his life.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is the one that you mentioned, the tireless personality of Dr. Trond Ali Lienstad.
Yes.
That he is questioned in an interview that, okay, why you left your life? You could be in a, you know, comfortable life, welfare, and you know, you left all these behind you, and now you are living, you know, in camps between Lebanon and Palestine under the bombardment. Why you have chosen this way? He says that I'm a Muslim, and Islam orders us or asks us to dedicate your life to defend the poor people and to stand for defending the right. So that's why I'm doing my best to dedicate my life for this true message of Islam.
That's all right.
So That's why I'm calling him a tireless man.
Yes.
That who, spent more than 40 years in this way up to now.
Yes.
And may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala increase his tawfiq in this way.
And protect
Another him. Important yes. point is that the role of Quran in his life.
Okay.
And I want to emphasize on the role of guidance of Quran in the life of people. Mm-hmm. He himself says that when I was invited to travel to Iran, I came to Iran. He had a meeting with Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. And after that, he was fascinated by the personality, great personality of late Imam. And after that, he decides to study about Islam. That's why he refers to Quran. He studies Quran from the beginning up to the end.
Okay.
He thought, and again, he decided to study. And for the third time, he studied the Holy Quran after the previous two times. After studying three times, he came to this point, okay, this is the true path. And he was that brave, as my dear brother Sheikh Mahdavi mentioned, he was that brave that he announced it publicly.
Okay.
And as he mentioned, Dr. Ali paid the price for this, path, and that's why he was deprived from the Royal Medal of Norway. And let me correct myself. At the beginning, I mentioned he was he understood that Jews are different. No, he understood that Zionists are different with the propaganda that they are spreading all over the world. So he himself also emphasizes on this point that Zionists are equalizing themselves by Jews, but they are not the same.
Okay.
He says that, and we all know this, that Zionist is a political party that is, oppressing people, but Jews are followers of a great religion, are followers of a great prophet, Prophet Moses. May God bless his soul. So they are different. And we have many Jews all over the world who are against Zionists Israel.
And just look in what a tragic world we are living. Nowadays, recently, we have heard that some of the Arab countries are trying to establish a relation with Israel, and they did that, okay? They officially announced that we consider Israel as an official land. They try to establish ties with the Israel country, and they do not see that how much the people are, we can say, under the disaster and the harm and the catastrophes that are taking place in the occupied Palestine. From the other one, a man from the Western world, from Norway, who converted to the religion of Islam, I think, and understood Islam better than so many of these so-called kings of the Arab countries in the Middle East, comes here, becomes the source